This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Joining me is Kelly Warden. How's it going, Kelly?
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, good, good.
That's good.
Here with you for another hour of Indie Media. But before we tell you about that, huge thanks to Jeff for another superb edition of On The Record. The man of the chops, the man of the golden voice. He'll be back next Monday. But of course, you can catch On The Record every weekday here on RTRFM from 9 in the AM. As I said, this is the Indie Media Show. We're talking all the sort of the news and interviews from the interwebs. On today's show, we're going to be talking about a strike that occurred in New South Wales last week. Thousands of nurses rallied outside the New South Wales Parliament, and this has come after, you know, I guess many attacks on their wages and conditions, and they're calling for significant changes to the sector. But yeah, staff at around 150 public hospitals participated in the staggered strikes across the state on Tuesday. And to find out a bit about that and why nurses are taking industrial action, a little later we're going to be chatting to Paula Sanchez. She's a lecturer in nursing and midwifery in New South Wales and also a registered nurse with more than 20 years experience.
Oh, yeah, and also we had an interview with Jaspreet Kaur, who she is the project and finance manager at Gender and Disaster Australia. Gender and Disaster Australia focuses specifically on research and outreach for communities affected by bushfire to mitigate and help prevent the rising rates of domestic violence that tends to occur after those natural disaster events. So we had a really great conversation with her that we'll be playing for you later.
So lots of reasons to keep it locked this morning to Indie Media on RTRFM 92.1. Yeah, we're going to be talking a little bit about some industrial action that occurred in New South Wales. Thousands of nurses rallied outside the New South Wales Parliament last week. This is after years or decades of attacks on their wages and conditions. The healthcare professionals turned out in large numbers, despite the ruling from the Industrial Relations Commission late on Monday that the strike should not go ahead. Staff at around 150 public hospitals participated in staggered strikes across the state. To find out a bit about the strikes and the current situation in New South Wales in the health sector, we're now joined by Paula Sanchez. Paula is a university lecturer of nursery and midwifery, and she's been a registered nurse for more than 20 years as a specialist in critical care. Paula, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. Hi, nice to meet you.
Now, this strike was the first in a decade to take place in New South Wales. Can I start by, getting your perspective on why do you think this strike is occurring now? I mean, I guess for a lot of our listeners, they would assume it's connected, of course, to the COVID situation. But what events led up to last week's strike?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the COVID situation, and I think the COVID situation may... our situation as nurses and midwives and healthcare workers in general worse. It put in evidence the failures of the system, and it's something that we've been trying to demand for many, many years. We need to take into consideration also that nurses and midwives and healthcare workers in general traditionally don't protest. We don't strike for many reasons. I think it's to do with, want to look after the patients. We don't want to leave them alone. We need to be there to provide care, not abandoning our patients. So it takes a while for us to walk out. But the situation is just gone worse over the years. What everybody knows, it's been 10 years since we actually had a strike action. But it's something that we've been demanding from 1976, for instance, night shift penalty is 15%. And for more than 20 years we've been, you know, wanting to get more than that for night shift nurses and midwives, because we know, you know, statistically speaking and looking at research shows that people that do night shift tend to have more problems with the heart, cardiovascular disease, depression, nutritional or diet problems. They tend to be overweight or underweight, problems with mental health, and many other problems. They die younger. There's actually research shows that people that do night shift die younger. And there's a lot of evidence to show that night shift can affect people's health. And we've just been asking for a bit more salary at night, more than 15% penalty. Since 1976, and still today, we've got 15% penalty. So that hasn't happened. So there's a lot of different things that have been accumulated. But I think COVID made it even more evident, and that's what exploded, you know?
Certainly. Now, the healthcare sector is certainly one here in Australia that has been greatly impacted on by the effects of privatisation and casualisation. And we've really seen this here in Western Australia with a lot of, I guess, our public hospitals, if not closing down, they're shutting down certain departments and so forth. Do you think that has been a significant part of the problem there in New South Wales, that the privatisation of hospitals, has that led to greater job insecurity and also greater casualisation of positions there?
I do think so, especially with the aged care sector. The aged care sector is being privatized many years ago, and they're struggling. They're struggling. The New South Wales Nurses Association, Nurses and Midwives Association, have been complaining about that for a long time, and there's been a lot of complaints. There's been a lot of proposals that have been given, put up to things to improve. But I'm a very strong believer that, yes, privatization of the system has made things worse. Well, if you want to talk about the bigger picture, I'm talking about the privatization of health. You know, having private health system, it has made things, it's making the public health system worse. I've been in Australia for 34 years now, and I can see the changes. You know, the system in Australia is still quite a good health system, but things have changed. Things, privatization started, and it's, I work a lot with my PhD work or my doctorate work is to do with oral health and cardiovascular disease. And we know how the oral health system is in Australia. You know, it's, access is hard. People have to long waiting lists. So it's health in general that is actually need to improve. Mm. Back to the nurses, yes, it's something that we've been struggling for a while. And I think this was the time that nurses and midwives said, this is enough. We're not coping anymore.
Certainly. Now, the New South Wales Nurses and Midwives Association General Secretary, Brett Holmes, accused the New South Wales Premier, Dominic Perrott, of being out of touch with the real world and the reality of working through the Omicron wave in hospitals. I mean, I guess here in Western Australia, we're just starting to see the real the impacts of Omicron as we begin to open up our borders here. But it's been, I guess, quite shocking for a lot of people to watch on the amount of cases occurring in New South Wales. And I guess just the reality that governments have had a couple of years now to really put funding into hospitals, but it seems as though at least some state governments aren't doing that. I guess talking to your colleagues and through your research, what has the response been like in terms of, the state government, New South Wales state government's response to COVID there? And is it adequate? Has it been adequate in terms of offering the support to nursing staff and healthcare staff?
Well, the response has been poor. And I think that's what it turns up to be, we end up striking and we're planning to continue if things do not improve. So, no, there's been little response. Financial response has been little. One of the things that the nurses are complaining about is, let's say, lack of equipment, PPE, personal protective equipment, the goggles and the gowns and the gloves. Sometimes we get equipment that it doesn't even fit, but we have to wear that, it's the equipment, the financial resources, employing more staff is been a problem. What Brett Holmes is talking about is that they're really saying that things are fine, the situation is fine, they minimize it. You know, the media in general is minimizing the situation, saying everything is good. We got issues with, you know, many nurses have been on the front face of the media, and they've been very limited on what they can say. You know, they have to say, are we, you know, struggling? They can't even say they're struggling. They have to say that we're doing well, we're working hard, and I take my hat off to the nurses. But when it comes down to talking about the real issues, that is, we don't have enough staff. The ratios are a problem. Then we can't say anything, you know, whistleblowing and all that. There's laws now against us that we cannot talk much about it. But the situation is not that good.
Paola, when the the pandemic first began, there was a lot of discussion, you know, particularly, I guess, within the left and within unions about how, you know, we can't return to normal, that the pandemic is demonstrating that, you know, the ways in which our systems, that our governance has gone, has really, you know, not valued human life, not valued, you know, the natural environment and so forth. And we need to use this as a kind of a turning point, I guess. And obviously, this is a very broad question. But, you know, do you think that for a lot of people, particularly those working in the healthcare sector, that this really has been a bit of a, you know, a light bulb moment, so to speak, in terms of, you know, making them realize that we need to invest in healthcare and we need to maybe change our thinking about, you know, the entire system and the way we approach health?
Yes, I agree with you. And it's sad to see this because many of us are passionate about what we do. As an educator, you know, I work in nursing for many, many years. As you said, more than 20 years in critical care, intensive care, and now educating the next generations of nurses. You start to see that many are leaving and many are deciding not to continue nursing. Many of our students that work very hard and they got jobs as assistant nurses during the pandemic because the hospitals were desperate to employ people, so they're employing, you know, student nurses to actually look after the patients because there's nobody else. There's no registered nurses. And there are registered nurses, but they're not employing them because there's not money to employ them. So it's cheaper to employ an assistant nurse. So many of these students are deciding not to continue with nursing. They said it's not worth it. You know, it's too much work. It is, you know, workloads are huge. They have to look after so many patients. We've been fighting and we're talking about ratios. You know, we're talking about that in the general wards, we want one nurse for every four patients. But this is not happening. We have a nurse with 6, 8, 10, 12, 15 patients sometimes, especially night shift or after hours. So it is hard to see. And I think, yes, you're right. We need to improve the system in general. The more money and resources need to be put into health. I believe education as well. And start removing some of that, all those billions of dollars that they're using in buying, you know, military weapons and things to go to war in some country that's not even attacking us. I'm sorry, this is my personal opinion, but I think the resources have not been distributed to the good of the people.
Certainly, we have to agree with you on that one. We've been speaking to Paola Sanchez, who is a university lecturer of nursing and midwifery and has been a registered nurse for more than 20 years, specialising in critical care. Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning, Paola. And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1 with myself, Raymond Grenfell, and Kelly Warden.
Awesome. So our next interview is with Jaspreet Kaur, who is the Project and Finance Manager at Gender and Disaster Australia. This year, the focus of the United Nations Women's Conference on the Status of Women is looking at women and climate change. And of course, one of the many consequences of climate change is increasing rates of natural disaster events. And what we know from a growing body of international research is that gender-based violence often increases significantly in the aftermath of disasters. And considering the recent spate of bushfires that have occurred in WA Southwest, we thought this was a pivotal time to start raising awareness of the fact that our country is no exception to this. Since 2009, Gender and Disaster Australia has been documenting how our culture and the way we are socialised into certain gender norms creates a social landscape upon which violence against women is exacerbated in the wake of bushfires. As I said, today we spoke to a representative from Gender and Disaster Australia, Jaspreet Kaur, who has has a background in architecture and a master's degree in disaster design and development. She is a proud Sikh woman and is passionate about challenging and questioning the status quo. In her free time, she loves all things craft, reading and chai. And I was very excited to speak with her about this topic that is severely underrepresented in our conversations around climate change.
Gender and Disaster Australia began as an initiative of two women's health services and Monash University, which was called Gender and Disaster Pod. And basically, so what we did was we're a research organisation that looks at promoting an understanding of the role played by gender in how people respond to disasters and to really embed these insights that we got from our research into the emergency management sector and the practices that they have within that sector. So as I mentioned earlier, a lot of our initial work was doing research. So in 2009, after Black Saturday, we, Women's House of the Northeast up in Northeast Victoria, commissioned a research piece called The Way He Tells It, which looks at women's experiences of family violence after Black Saturday. And then what followed after that was research looking into men on Black Saturday. We also did research pieces looking at living LGBTI during disasters and women's leadership in emergency management and also long-term disaster resilience. And recently, just last year, in 2019, we released three pieces of research looking at COVID-19 and the impacts on elderly people, LGBTI communities and the primary prevention practitioners. And so from this research, what we've really tried to do is break it down so that we can explain and bring what we've found in our research out to everyone in communities. So it's not in academic jargon. It's, you know, plain English. It's something that everyone can understand. And we've done this through creating postcards. Our main one is looking at disasters, no excuse for family violence, which people can use if they have disclosures of family violence to them. And there's a four-step process that they can undertake so that they can provide the support that people need and also provide numbers for referral services to organisations that can help support the person that's disclosed family violence. And we've also translated a lot of this research into training packages that allows organisations or communities that have either been impacted by disasters or are working within the disaster recovery recovery space to better understand family violence increasing, but also the gendered impacts of disasters on women, men and people of diverse gender and sexual identities. You know, all of these are also available on our website, so if anyone is interested in looking at them, they're readily available on our website and can be downloaded and read at your leisure.
Fantastic. Yeah, that was one of the reasons why I was really keen to get Gender and Disaster on the show, because I think you guys do have so much important public information available on this topic that's often so underrepresented in our conversations about disasters and climate change. As you sort of mentioned, Gender and Disaster Australia was sort of born out of the back of the Black Saturday bushfires that happened in 2009. And, you know, like international research has shown that the increase in domestic violence that happened after that is not, you know, only found in Australia. It's sort of an international issue. But obviously, culture is a really big driver as to why this happens. And depending on the cultural context, there's slightly different drivers that are sort of creating these environments where violence against women increases. I was wondering if you could maybe discuss some of the specific cultural drivers behind the increasing rates of violence against women in the wake of the Black Saturday bushfires in particular.
Yeah, sure. So basically the drivers aren't very, the drivers for violence happening after disasters isn't that dissimilar to the drivers of family violence occurring just in our society generally. But what we've seen in a disaster context and what really influences family violence in a disaster context is we see a return to gendered stereotypes and roles. And what that means is when we look at the way in which women and men respond, we often see men taking this protector role and really being pushed by society as well to take on this role of, you know, protector and provider, of protecting the property, of trying to, you know, put out the flames or taking on that responsibility, or even after disasters or after you know, the disaster is happening, you know, to get back on their feet and to bring, you know, to recover, to reconstruct, to build a house as quickly as possible, to put everything back the way it was before the fires. You know, there's a lot of pressure on men to do that. And for women, it's that role of carer. It's that expectation that women will take on that role of being a carer within their family and even in the larger community, that, you know, when the bushfire happens, that they'll take care of the kids or they'll take care of the elderly, any elderly parents that are staying with them, and that when they go out into community or they're in a, you know, in a community setting, that they'll take care of the community. Yeah, and we also see this within the response to evacuations. We tend to see that men tend to want to stay back and fight the fires, which leads back to that protector mentality of, you know, I have to protect, this is our home, and, you know, I need to fight to protect it. And in for women in evacuations, it's often that they want to leave and they want to evacuate. They want to remove themselves from the disaster. And because of that, they tend to get left. They tend to have that responsibility of organising the kids, getting them into the car, making sure that all the things that they want to take with them, you know, any clothes or anything that they can take with them, are packed up in the car, ensuring that they have anything that they really want to keep, like photos and stuff like that, and have been organised and all of that, and then ensuring that they get out safely. The other thing that we see is the hero myth that promotes unrealistic versions of masculinity and male forms of heroism. I think, you know, when we look at bushfires, we tend to see, you know, people in uniform, and they're called heroes, and that sort of language is used around people that are helping out in the fires. And so what we see is that when men are unable to perform or meet these unrealistic expectations of masculinity, of protector and provider, if they can't protect or provide, especially in a disaster context where you don't actually have control over what a bushfire is going to do. You don't have control over, you know, where it's going to go, what's going to happen. It's a very touch and go situation. Things can change at the last minute. So, you know, when they can't actually perform and meet these unrealistic expectations of masculinity, they try to reclaim this power and control, and that can be through violence against their partner in the disaster context. Again, the pre-existing inequality that we have within our society, you know, we see unequal pay gaps. We see, you know, systemic discrimination against women that is exacerbated during these disasters. And then the last driver that we see in disasters is the fact that decision making in public and private life is dominated by men and or patriarchal forms of power and authority. So, you know, like when you look at who is giving the information or who's in the media talking about the disasters, it's often men in uniform at the forefront, and you very rarely see women being represented in as leaderships or as leaders within community or within organisations at the forefront talking about these issues.
Yeah, you're so right. It kind of comes back to that whole, like you say, the notion of like protector and provider, and it's definitely very telling of like how we are sort of socialising men in our society, and exactly why we need to start changing some of those gender expectations. And I guess also what you've said is that there's, you know, it's often sort of an underrepresented issue. It's not something that we really talk about, and it's got a lot to do with the fact that there is that sense of, you know, these people or these men have been through a hard time, they've experienced trauma, and so sometimes it's a little bit conflicting to start talking about, you know, the fact that sometimes they're then perpetrators of this violence in the aftermath. But that's quite different to what sort of happened with the pandemic. There's been a lot of awareness and media coverage about the fact that domestic violence has risen since the beginning of the pandemic. And it's something that both the federal and state governments have pushed a lot of funding towards, because there is this, you know, public concern for women's safety in times of crisis. But when it comes to bushfires, there just doesn't seem to be that same level of community awareness or media attention. And I was just wondering if you could sort of talk to why you think that is.
Definitely. And I think you hit it on the nail when you were talking before around, you know, we one of the first things is that we don't actually want to hear about it in a bushfire context, and the hero myth plays a really big role in this, and the idea that because the perpetrator of violence is a good bloke, that he was on the back of the fire truck or that he's now suffering or unemployed, you know, somehow excuses him of being a perpetrator of family violence is a really big thing. You know, we don't want to think of our boys and our men who fought the fires, you know, or maybe community leaders or have contributed to the recovery after the bushfires as being violent towards their family. And that, you know, and like you said, you know, we acknowledge that there's been trauma, you know, that people have lost their houses, there's been loss, there's a lot of, you know, factors that need to be considered, but it does not, you know, we can't let that be an excuse to say that family violence is an acceptable response after disasters, you know. And we tend to excuse this behaviour by saying that he's, you know, like he's gone through the fires, he just needs time. And we often forget that women have gone through the same disaster and the trauma as well. And then I think it's really important for everyone to understand that disaster is no excuse for family violence, and it's not helpful to anyone to have this response after a disaster. It doesn't help women and children, and it doesn't help men. And so when we compare this to the COVID-19 context, where our healthcare workers, a majority of whom are women, are at the front lines and are being labelled the heroes, we can accept that men are perpetrating family violence, and that we should be helping women leaving and getting men the help that they need. And it's because in this narrative, in this disaster, the men aren't the heroes.
You're with Indie Media on RTR FM 92.1, and we're speaking to Jaspreet Kaur, who is the Project and Finance Manager at Gender and Disaster Australia. Yeah, it's so interesting that, isn't it? Like the division of gender roles and who we sort of elevate in our minds as being the ones that are keeping the community safe. But it's so true what you say. I mean, like, you, even not in a disaster context, we sort of make excuses, you know, for violence against women. And I think in one of the papers that Gender and Disaster Australia published, you cited a study that was sort of a nationwide study on people's attitudes towards domestic violence. And I think it was in 2017 that there was still a section of Australian society that would excuse a man perpetrating domestic violence against a partner if, you know, he was remorseful afterwards, or if he was really angry and he lost control, or if he had experienced it as a child, or, you know. And I think, as you say, these things are just sort of exacerbated in the context of a crisis. But I guess going on to my next question, Gender and Disaster Australia recently received a huge amount of funding of $3.7 million from the federal government, which is really exciting. And, you know, being like a big supporter of the work you do, I was wondering what, you know, your sort of intentions are for that funding, and if there was scope for Gender and Disaster Australia to sort of expand its research and outreach and training to communities over here in Western Australia.
Definitely, definitely. So our plans over the next 4 years is to roll out our training that we've been creating since our research has come out. And, you know, we've had iterations come through when new research has come through. And basically what we want to do is roll that out all over Australia. So roll out our training as well as our train the model across Australia. So we definitely want to roll out our training in Western Australia. So if there are organisations that are listening in who would like more information about our training and getting access to it, you know, please reach out. We definitely would like to go into Western Australia and be able to provide our training to communities and organisations around there.
Yeah, hopefully there are some organisations tuning in, because we've obviously got a huge spate of bushfires happening over in our southwest region. So that was sort of part of the reason why we thought this would be a good time to have this conversation and discuss the work that's being done by Gender and Disaster Australia, because I guess as we've mentioned, it's a pretty underrepresented issue in the way that we talk about recovery from different natural disasters. And I guess, yeah, this was kind of my final question, because I like to sort of finish on something that, you know, the audience can take away to sort of implement in their own lives to help with these different issues. So the research that's coming out from Gender and Disaster Australia is obviously very telling of how we are socialising people in our culture and society to conform to very specific and often quite toxic binary gender roles. And as you've mentioned, in a disaster context, whether that's a bushfire or a pandemic, these crisis situations tend to exacerbate those pre-existing gender roles. And I guess what we're seeing with climate change is that our propensity to experience disasters are only going to be increasing. So it does make me wonder what some of those specific gendered stereotypes or social norms are that we could be challenging now as a way of mitigating against some of those negative outcomes in the future.
So, you know, as you've already mentioned, disasters are exacerbating something that's already pre-existing within our society. It's not something that's new that comes out after disasters. It's something that's already there, and it's just being multiplied by 10 after disaster context. And looking back at research, it shows us that there's a 50-year setback after disasters, with men and women retreating back to traditional roles that were more common 50 years back. And so things that people can take away and actually implement within their own lives is to, there's, you know, I say they're simple things, but in certain situations it can be hard to actually action. But it's things like, you know, calling out the disrespect of women. You know, if people are making sexist jokes, it's, you know, a question why they think something like that is funny, why they think it's okay to be making jokes like that. It's, you know, calling out harmful gendered stereotypes. If people are justifying, you know, that I personally need to be doing something because I'm a woman, well, then, you know, that needs to be called out. It needs to be stopped. And it also needs to be questioned around why I should be doing something just because I'm a woman, you know. There's things like being aware that our language is really powerful, that it's really important that we, the language that we use, you know, whether it be simply as, you know, it, rather than fireman, we use the term firefighter, but, you know, we're acknowledging that it's a gender neutral occupation, that it's not just for men, that women can also be firefighters. It's, you know, it's questioning those behaviours, you know, like, you know, like I've heard of this, like when we were younger, you know, you'd be on the playground and a boy, you know, pulls your pigtails or, you know, pushes you around and, you know, you go tell someone and they're like, oh, he's just doing it because he likes you. You know, it's questioning behaviours like that and actually, you know, calling that out and being like, no, actually, that's not appropriate behaviour and we should be taking actions to rectify it. Because if we don't, we normalise this behaviour, and what we're teaching young boys is that it's okay to hurt a girl because you like her, and it's okay, and it's teaching young girls that, you know, oh, just because he hurts you doesn't mean, you know, it's just his way of showing affection and love. It's creating that sort of culture that normalises this behaviour and makes it okay, so that when they grow up, they're growing up with this mentality that, oh, you know, that guy hit me, but, you know, it's okay because he just likes me, he just loves me a lot, and it's okay. And, you know, I shouldn't be questioning that. I think the other thing is also, you know, this is something I've seen quite often as well, is, you know, we tend to stop young boys from showing emotion. You know, I remember, you know, a young boy getting hurt recently, and, you know, his family being like, oh, you know, and he was crying, he was upset and he was scared because of the pain. And, you know, them being like, oh, you know, stop, you're a strong boy, you know, strong boys don't cry. And it's like, well, actually they do, and it's okay for them to cry because they're hurting. And letting them feel that emotion and being able to, you know, come to terms with the fact that they've been hurt, and that it's okay for them to cry when they're hurt and express that emotion.
Awesome. So, as Jaspreet mentioned, Gender and Disaster Australia have some really exciting training resources and programs for organisations that they've been developing since 2009. So if there are any WA organisations tuning in, we'd really encourage you to, you know, get familiar with their research. And if you want to find out more, do head over to their website at www.genderanddisaster.com.au. They're currently taking expressions of interests for their gender and disaster training, if you're interested in that.
pretty much all we got time for today on the Indie Media Show. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, Ray.
Yeah, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. If you enjoyed the program, you can always restream the whole show at rtrfm.com.au. It's also, I think, available as a podcast, and you can listen to a whole stack of our interviews via our SoundCloud. If you'd like to get in touch, please do. If you've got an idea for some content for the show, you can always hit us up via RTR, or if you're into the whole corporate social media thing, you can get in touch with us there. But keep it locked, though, as after the news, Rhianne Todd-Hunter is going to take you out to lunch. All your new fresh tracks for your Monday afternoon. But we'll be back next week, won't we? But as we say every week on Indie Media,
don't hate the media.
Become the media.
Love that.